good. Thank you.
Carrie.
She walks away. Thank you, Carrie. Thanks to the Melvick American Museum, the Friends of the Mag Library. Mog, excuse me. And the Room of Requirement. Thank you for this invite. I've been here before, not this room, but I've been here in 2010. This is going to be a rough night. This is a rough night. It's a rough crowd. All right. First, I should tell you that at dinner tonight, the very serious folks from the Room of Requirement, I said, I can do this lecture without notes. It's a lot more lively without notes, but I also can crash and burn if I do it without notes. Or I can do it, I can just read it. And the unanimous vote was, we want to see you crash and burn. So I'll refer to the notes occasionally. If I crash and burn, I want your sympathy. So you're putting those five in there. The first talk I gave about Harry Potter was to a C.S. Lewis Society group in Port Townsend, Washington. And in it, I talked about literary alchemy because I thought that all of them would understand what literary alchemy was. C.S. Lewis uses alchemical symbols and tropes in the Narnian, but also in his Ravens and Hobbes, much more heavily in the Ravens and Hobbes. But Angela's going to get me a glass of water because she is born. It's like Donald Trump tonight. Sorry, I had to bring one question. Check. And they didn't. This group of very old men, I don't think they're very old, they're now my age now, they don't seem so old anymore. But they said, you're going to explain this alchemy to me a little bit more. And I thought, this is, those characters in black, white, and red. You have a character, the title of the first book is Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. He goes through a big transformation at the end of every book, where he dies and rises again. No, it's not good, of course, John. What are you talking about? Well, that's become a trope. That's become a thing. Right? I talk about Joan Rowland and I say she's a literary alchemist. She's playing alchemical drama like Shakespeare. And either I get the big eyeball roll, oh yeah, she's like Shakespeare, done. Or I get the that's preposterous. When I first did this, there was a reviewer at Christianity Today, who's now Houston Baptist, who wrote a real takedown. A nasty piece, it didn't my name, thank God, but he was definitely about this crazy man who's talking about alchemy and Harry Potter. And he basically said that I was something like a conspiracy theorist on literary criticism. But I had one big secret key to Harry Potter with alchemy, and I thought I was a nut. And I said, that's how my mind. And then in 2008, they found an interview, 2007, February 2007. I remember the day when they found this interview that Rowling had done in 1998. And she was asked, did you ever want to be a witch? And she said, no, I've never wanted to be a witch. But an alchemist, now that's a different matter. To invent this wizard world, I've learned a ridiculous amount about alchemy. Perhaps much of it I'll never use in the books, but I have to know in detail what magic can and cannot do in order to set the parameters and establish the story's internal logic. I never got an apology from the guy who called me a nutter about the alchemy.
I'm waiting. Before they come and ask my apology, I'm looking for it still. I've become what Lev Grossman calls the dean of Harry Potter scholars because of weird things that I was able to see inside Harry Potter that most readers miss. And the reason that is not because I'm especially brilliant, though Fiona, if you want to believe that, I grew up in the same church that Rowling grew up in, obviously, in England. I was in Pennsylvania, New Jersey. I grew up in Episcopal Church in the United States, from the Catholic community. We both were classicists, we both studied Latin Greek in university training. We both went to similar schools, great books type schools. We both read a lot of 19th century literature, and we both read a lot about alchemy. So when I was reading the Harry Potter stories, I was thinking, wow, this is great, look at that! And he would say, look at what? I said, no, look right there! There's a guy named Sirius Black. And Albus Dumbledore, his name means white in Latin. And again, he would look like, John, that's great. You went to school and learned these Latin words. And Rubius Hagrid, the red, black, white, and red. Like Shakespeare, black, white, and red. And they'd be like, black, white, and red, Shakespeare, what are you talking about? So that's about what I was talking about. And how important it is for understanding Harry Potter, but also for understanding all the things that are derivative from Harry Potter. It's important to understand the stuff that comes before Harry Potter. In fact, if you like stories, you get involved in stories, which means that you're a human being, because frankly, you're telling stories to yourself about yourself around the clock. Your nighttime dreams and your daydreams are all you're telling stories about yourself. So people call it human beings homo ficus. That we are people, we are the storytelling animal. And that all of our lives are just about we're being the good guys and them being the bad guys and how we're going to beat them. If you get tonight's lecture, you'll have a much better clue as to how to write your own story. Why these stories are the best-selling books since A Little Red Book and Jerry Mouth. And he had a lot of help with distribution. All right. First, let's start with metallurgical alchemy, because that's probably where we all start. We all had our first day in high school chemistry class where the guy said, chemistry starts with a bunch of nutcases in the Middle Ages trying to turn lead into gold. Now, we all nodded our heads, that was stupid and worthless, more stupid, this facade and us. There was a group of people that did try to turn lead into gold, and that was their primary focus, was to turn lead into gold and make a lot of money. And to con people, and then they make money for it, by the way. But that was Renaissance alchemy. They call it exoteric alchemy. Some people call them charcoal burners. It usually it's just stain. And it's not alchemy of the Middle Ages. It's not alchemy like it was in China, like it was in the Levant. There's an Islamic alchemy. There's a Kabbalistic Hebrew alchemy. There's obviously a Western Christian alchemy. And it all appears at the same time. So unless you believe there was a uniform mania that spread around the world around the 12th and 13th centuries, ending there at that time, there must be something else this alchemy game than these con artists that became chemists. And that group, usually called the esoteric alchemists, or the spiritual alchemists, they had a different ambition than just turning lead into gold. They had a twofold ambition. The first was to turn lead into gold. All the purification pipes, all the things broke down. There's actually a lot of literature work going on. But the most important thing they're about is the purification of their own hearts, their spiritual essence. And quite literally, their enlightenment or their illumination. Now this is kind of tough because if anyone talks to you about they say they're an alchemist and they're doing it in their garage or whatever, just walk away slowly, because there are pure alchemists. Okay, if you live in this age, there are certain beliefs that you have, certain foundational parts of your understanding that prevent you from being an alchemist. And the number one thing that blocks you from doing that is that we're all materials. Okay? Not only do we believe that energy and matter are the building blocks of everything in existence, which is an internal contradiction. But we believe that between subject and object is a chasm which cannot be crossed. The knowing subject and the known object are actually distinct and separate. That is a tenet of all modern thinking. That you out there are other, and there is nothing between us for understanding other than cultural gaps. That is absolutely anathema and idiocy to
traditional peoples of the five great revolution. That's absurd, isn't it? And that's what really separates Western materialist culture from all the great traditions. The great traditions believe, with Samuel Taylor Coleridge and others, that the fact that Coleridge's line is the foundation of all knowing is the coincidence of subject and object. And there is no way you understood that on the first run. So let's try that again. The foundation of all knowledge is the coincidence of subject and object. There's only one place in nature where you have a coincidence of subject and object. Where is that? Oh, you all? No. Oh, by the teacher. A mirror. You stand in front of a mirror, and the knowing subject and the known object, its reflection, are seemingly the same thing. That's why mirrors are a big deal at the exhibition. We'll come back to this. How can all knowledge be founded in the coincidence of subject and object? To get that, you have to understand what's called the logos of epistemology. This is kind of heavy, but we're talking about alchemy here, so if you came for a real lecture, I'm sorry, I'd love to be here harder than you do, but okay. We're going to start hard and get easier. Logos of epistemology is that there is a faculty within you, usually called the heart or the eye of the heart in traditional cultures. And this faculty is not yours, per se. Okay? It's more like your conscience. A conscience, the word in Latin comes from shared, known, where it's a faculty which is common to us all. I wish that my conscience were me, because then my conscience wouldn't do what it usually does, kicking in after I've done something stupid. Okay. I'm like, whoa, don't be telling me I've got to walk that back. Where were you before it came out my mouth? But it's always there to say, oh, John, oh, man, are you going to pay for that? Where were you? But that shared faculty that we all have in common in traditional cultures is that aspect of us which, in C.S. Lewis's language, is continuous with the fabric of reality. That basically the entire creation, if you will, is brought into existence each moment by a logos, or the Tao, whatever we call that principle, that creative principle, and that principle is reflected in you, that you have a logos inside of you. That logos inside of you means that when I look at you, I can say, that is a human being, because the logos inside of me recognizes its reflection, coincidence of subject and object, and knows itself. So all knowing is the coincidence of subject and object, because I can look at the chair and I can see the chair. Now, if I'm a materialist, I look at the chair and I try to pick it up. I weigh it, I put an autoclave and I burn it, I get some numbers, I get some data, right? I think I know it, but I've got to give it to you, and you've got to measure it and burn it and get data which is really doggone close, and then you know it. The tradition would say, that doesn't tell you anything about the share. That's stupid. You don't recognize that share because of that. The logos inside of you recognizes the logos of a chair and says, here's what this is. Jesus of Nazareth, for you Christians, is this principle incarnate. It's your toes to nose. We have this faculty, hesitantly, everybody has a different relationship to this faculty, right? Some people are really attuned to their conscience. Some people are still waiting for that day, when they wake up upon their conscience. The Christians believe that Jesus of Nazareth is this faculty exclusively. He is only that logos. When he said, this always bothered me when I was a kid growing up, when they would say, love your neighbor as yourself. I thought, no way. You can talk about altruism and self-sacrifice and all this stuff. I was like, love my neighbor as myself? Not happening. When I had my little Coleridge moment, though, I went, oh, I get what this logos guy is talking about. He's talking about himself. When you love your neighbor as yourself, you're saying is this logos faculty is going to look at that faculty that's bringing you into existence moment to moment and say, oh, this is that part of me which is most me, the most metaphysically real, the absolute part of me. the eternal aspect of me. And I look at you and see the same thing. Of course I look at myself, because what's most real in you is what's most real in me. So because it's just involved in the whole altruistic, pietistic thing. According to traditional Christians, the Lord is saying, love your neighbor as yourself, because she or he is, in essence, yourself. Now, what does that do with alchemy? The alchemist is saying, there's an essence to this lead. And this lead, we think of lead as what PD on the periodic table, right? Home base. You know, this is the stuff we make pipes out of. That's not how traditional people see lead, and they see solid darkness. Right? Hard as rock darkness. Which means that the light of the world, which is like this logos, the light of the world is not. This is like stillborn matter. It was born without the light of the world evident in it. And so what to turn lead into gold is to turn this stillborn metal into its perfection metal, which would be solid light, which is what gold is. Gold and silver are uniformly revered across the world and across cultures as the most valuable metals because they reflect light. There seems to be this essential quality. What the alchemist is after is the illumination of this metal by purification exercises, and while he, and I'm sorry, there are no women alchemists in history. Don't. I got four daughters and a wife. This is not John the Sexist Guy. There aren't any women alchemists. Some will say that Perennio Flamel was put on the the alchemist is saying, as he's pursuing this, that while the metal is being purified, he's trying to illumine his own heart, which is darkened just by the nature of being human in time and space and fall. He wants to become this faculty, this essence himself. He wants to be illumined and enlightened and become this light of the world. Basically, the whole point of traditional alchemy is to return man to an Adamic perfection. Not greater than Adam, which is what Christians are after in the resurrection, but as good as Adam in the garden. A natural perfection before a supernatural perfection through the sacraments of the church. Now, that's a lot. That's what alchemy is really about. Are we still on board? Pretty wild, though, right? Mm-hmm. Alchemy is not nut jobs. Your chemistry teacher is a nut job.
I want to go back and strangle my chemistry teacher when I learned all this stuff. Where was he when I really needed him? All right. Now, you really didn't come here to hear about John talking about traditional alchemy. And all the things.
You want to hear about Alice Dyson doing literature. I get it. Now, there's two streams of alchemy in English literature. There's a great book called Dark Hieroglyphics by a man named Stanton Linden, University of Washington Press. It was actually an academic journal at the University of Texas called Caldep Pavonis. The tale of the peacock is an alchemical symbol. And it's only about alchemy in literature. So you think it's little John's little hobby horse, you know, no, the academic journal learns this. And Stanton Linden, who was the editor of that journal for many decades, he wrote in his book where there's two ways you see alchemy in English literature. The first one is just flat out satire, where novelists and poets laugh at the alchemists, the charcoal burners, the ones who are con artists and flute franchise. That would be Chaucer. Chaucer has a great take on the alchemist. It would be Swift in Gulliver's Travels, and it would be Samuel Butler in Erewhon. There you see the alchemist laughed at and belittled, and no use of imagery, just we're laughing at alchemists. The second stream is the more important. And it takes off because of, you know, a little-known playwright, William Shakespeare. That Shakespeare has a, we don't have his diaries or anything, so I can't really, I'm going to check this. He had a key insight. He makes a huge step. It's really radical.
he makes it clear that what happens in a theater is what happens in an alchemist's lab. In fact, Francis Yates, the expert on medieval and Renaissance science and medicine, says that the globe was a circle, and all the signs and symbols all the way around the globe were alchemical and astrological. And she said that the globe was designed as an alchemical crucible, and that Shakespeare's theater was Robert Flood, famous alchemist, on stage. And Shakespeare was trying to do in the theater what the alchemists were trying to do in the lab. And that may sound absurd, but if you think about it, not so much. Again, back to Coleridge. Coleridge says, when you enter into a story, you suspend disbelief in an active poetic thing. That's the quote from Coleridge, almost everybody knows. But what does that mean, to suspend disbelief in a poetic thing? Your disbelief is all of those rational, individual faculties that you have. Your thinking, your perception, your understanding. But when you're reading Harry Potter, you're not saying, well, that's a nice representation of Jane Austen there. If you do, there's a problem. I have that problem. You get into the story, and you're in the story, and all of a sudden, you're reading with that faculty of your heart. Percy Liotti says that in our times, a secular age, where really belief in the transcendent has been really kicked to the edge of the public square. We're all taught that atheism is stupid. In this age, he says, story serves a religious or mythic function. That it's the only place in which we can legitimately exercise this faculty of heart and not be embarrassed. If you go to church, we're like, we're going to church with all the dumb people. What am I doing here? When we read a story, we say, I'll enjoy a good story. Which is an entirely different feeling. We get oxygen to that faculty of heart. And usually we're just this identity comes with, I'm a Presbyterian, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Jew, I'm this and that. And that individualizes us rather than makes us this heart. We enter into a story and all of that falls away. All the disbelief, all of our tentative, accidental, historical, individual quality drops away, and all we are is our heart reading the story. And when that heart reads, what happens is what happens in the alchemist lab. That heart sees something it identifies with and is transformed simultaneously with that. And that's as old as Aristotle, right? Aristotle talks about when you watch a drama and you identify with the players on the stage, as they go through their agonies, you've experienced catharsis or purification along with them. That's an alchemical response. The reason that Americans are consumed by sport more than any culture in the world. I mean, sports, take a look at that building to the north of here or whatever. When you drive through Youngstown State, you don't say, I wonder what the really big thing is here on campus. It's about the drama of a sporting event. Our guys against their guys, and we're the good guys and the bad guys. It's a huge celebration of story and identity, a group identity, where we transcend ourselves and become part of a larger group, a larger story. And in the absence of a more compelling revelation, that's where we're at. Maybe it's a favorite television show, maybe it's Harry Potter. But why does Harry Potter do this better than this other story? I don't know Shakespeare that word. Shakespeare is as powerful as he is, even to this day. Even though most of us don't read him, we know that he is the foundation of the entire Western canon in literature. There's no escaping Shakespeare. He's not the elephant in the room, he's the sperm whale. And when Shakespeare decided to use alchemical images and glyphs and structures, the colors black, white, and red, there are almost no other colors in Shakespeare other than black, white, and red. And there's a reason for that. I'm going to go through just alchemical tropes, and I'll go through Romeo and Juliet. Most people, I've never read Romeo and Juliet or seen the movie.
that's, I found that's the most popular one. You better later if you do that one, I should have written. Shakespeare. This is like a alchemy comes in three stages. The first stage is called the negretto. And that's when you take a substance, usually lead, and you break it down to prime matter. It's a stage of absolute breakdown. Everything has to be destroyed inside the negretto. Burnt to a crisp. Usually it's a matter of burning fire. The second stage, and so the black stage is named because it usually burns something up. The white stage is when that prime matter, that base element, that thing removed of all of its superficial quality, when you strip it down right down to its base quality, that the white stage of the albedo is called the ablutionary stage. It's when everything's purified and washed away. A lot of white references and a lot of water references in this stage. And everything, all the big changes happen in the white stage. Then there's the red stage, the rubetto, in which there's a conflict and the change which has happened in the white stage comes to the fore. Alchemy is those three stages done in seven cycles. They all have different names on the cycle data. In alchemy, there's a play of contraries. There's always this opposing force. Usually it's alchemical mercury and alchemical sulfur. And they're back and forth, back and forth. There's always a play between these groups. In the drama, it's usually groups or individuals. And it's not subtle. You don't say, well, the Gryffindors and the Slytherins, they kind of have fight issues. It's one of those, wow, here's what defines the world. I'm crashing and burning, Angela. It's on you here. It's on you here. There's a quarreling couple, specifically a couple that represents alchemical mercury and alchemical sulfur in person. And they have some relationship with the primary player or players that brings them to purification. Mercury is considered to be the feminine pole and the more intelligent pole. Maybe that's you. I get my $4 in Homestead. And then the sulfur pole is the masculine or passionate, usually stupid side of things. Impulsive, ready to go, hardcore. And those two in the play or drama are having it out all the time. And when those two are resolved, then we're very close to the perfection of the Philosopher's Stone. There's an alchemical wedding, usually at the end of the white stage. There's an alchemical wedding between the Red King and the White Queen. And these two represent absolute contraries, sort of like mercury and sulfur again. And they'll get married, usually they'll die, and they'll have what's called the philosophical. Oftentimes there's some copulation scene over a crypt. It's really some of these bizarre alchemical images. Roland uses that image exactly in Casual Maintenance, the dead center of the novel. She has a couple going at it over the grave of the hero of the story. She's really in alchemy. And at the end there's usually a philosophical orphan or the philosopher's stone. And that stone will give off a tincture, which puts everything else in the bowl. There's something magical and special about that orphan or stone inside the stone. Something golden. All right. Remember about Romeo and Juliet? Let me do this with Tale of Two Cities because I think it's an absolute Shakespeare fanatic. That's a whole other lecture, but Tale of Two Cities is built right along these lines. Almost all books in the 19th century are three books. But he actually makes them into a black, white, and red stage. I'd love to talk about that. Anyway, back to Romeo and Juliet. Romeo and Juliet starts out, and it's the melancholy, depressing part of the story. Romeo's doing this, he's lost his girlfriend, it's a mess. Julie has said about the marriage, she's been forcing it, it's all downtime in the world, you know. And then, and the contraries inside Jonah, it's the capital that's in Montague. They're fighting each other in the streets. And the prince, the man in charge, is trying to get these contraries to resolve and make kissy and love each other, and it's not happening. Well, these two star-crossed lovers, they meet, and they decide that they're going to be this resolution of conflict. And sure enough, this red king and white queen get married by Brother Lawrence at the end of the white stage. They get married, and they consummate their marriage, and that's pretty much the happy ending to Romeo and Juliet. Oops. John Bonnet doesn't have a happy ending. If you leave at that point, it's a great story. Of course, there's a fight between Tybalt and Mercutio. Mercutio, of alchemical mercury and alchemical sulfur, which one do you think Mercutio might be? The relatively feminine and marvelously eloquent and insightful poet versus Tybalt, whose name translates roughly as kick-ass. He's just in it for a That's all he's there for. And so they start having out in a fight, a quarreling couple, and Romeo decides, oh no, it's all been resolved. All is happiness now. Capulets and Montagues are good. And Tybalt runs Mercutio through. And Romeo gets pulled out of his happy-go-lucky thing, gets pulled back into his Montague set, and he goes out to kill Tybalt, which he does. And then down, all the misunderstandings are in the world again. And he's exiled, comes back to misunderstanding, and doesn't wind up dead. You've seen the play. And at the end of it, you know, the families come together, and after four of the couples, what do the families decide to do?
Make peace.
They make peace. All is money down in Verona, the prince is happy. And what do they decide to do to commemorate Romeo and Juliet? They put up golden statues. Not especially obscure alchemical imagery there, right? They had turned into solid gold, these two lovers. They brought us through this by their illumination, their love for one another. Just like light and speech and word and love, they all are names for this principle which brings us into existence. So there's a Shakespeare, and you watch this play, and you think, these people are so stupid! Why can't they just get over this? And these poor kids, you know, be happy and loving! And you walk out of there committed to resolving the contraries in your life. You've experienced this whole community coming through this change through Romeo and Juliet. You are edified and uplifted. You've experienced this catharsis in the round with Shakespeare. I hope you do. And that's true of Two General of Verona. There's a great book out about King Lear now. He's escaping me right now. It's just kind of a topos or cliche in Shakespeare studies that it's all about alchemy. What does it have to do with Harry Potter? Well, think about those five things again. First of all, you should know that schoolboy novels don't come in sets of seven. Schoolboy novels come in sets of six. Okay? Rowling writes hers in set of seven because there are seven cycles of black, white, and red in alchemy. Each one of the books has a black, white, and a red stage. We start off with the Dursleys. If you don't get Best and the Greta, I'm sorry about your unfortunate childhood. if that was the right part of your life, get some counseling. And then he escapes from the dark Dursleys to the home of Albus Dumbledore, the White Sage. And at Hogwarts, Harry, you know, all pretty much goes with me. Harry, until the fifth book, never says, I wish I could be back on Privet Drive. Things have to go really bad in order to finish that to happen. We'll talk about that in a second. Every book, Harry goes there, he's under the tutelage of Albus Dumbledore, the White. And he resolves a mystery, fights the contraries, and all these things, and he comes to Ravenna, where he has to make a choice. He's saving people. He goes through this process of purification often in a year, usually because you never hear about him. They say a couple of things. They say, his scar hurt worse than ever before. So this is what it's like to die. He says that so often when it happens in the sixth book, and he's saying, oh, good, he's going to make it. Because every other time he said that, he comes through. We're waiting for the cavalry to arrive. And the other thing he says in every single book, most important, is, will you two shut up? I am so tired of you two quarreling. Right? Ron and Hermione going back at it, this and that. Okay. Could they be the quarreling couple? Here's a thought. Hermione's name. It's the feminine of Hermes. Hermes, of course, is the Greek for Mercury. Mercury is the feminine and intelligent sphere of things. Huh? We're getting here? Her initials are HG. Okay, we got some chemists in the room here. HG is the periodic table thing for Mercury. But my favorite word for her is her parents are dentists.
All you guys have got different types of fillings. They used to do mercury filling type stuff. Okay. On the other side of things, there's Ron. There's one point in the book where Hermione says, yeah, Ron, well, that's a good idea. And even Ron says, really? And when Ron says something, it's sort of the given stupid option. We're going to explore that just because we have to dismiss it. Ron is going to be the person who says it. Ron is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. His middle name is Bilious, which is something like sulfuric. He's the red-headed, passionate one. He's the one that's always popping off at the mouth. He's the one who never thinks about what he says. He's the one who's totally a prisoner of his passions. I'm afraid of spiders, all these things. I mean, Ron is the sulfuric side of him. And all through the series, Ron and Hermione are back and forth as the quarreling couple shaping Harry. And when they finally lock lips in the room of choir at the Deathly Hallows, the show is over. Harry has been perfected. So they finally are a couple, all is well. Rowling's recent comments to the contrary. All right. What else have we got here? The alchemical wedding. What is the alchemical wedding at the end of the white? Okay, let's go through the stages of the book. Every book has a black, white, and red stage, but really the last three books, probably the most depressing young adult novel ever written, is Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. How many of us went on medication after you read it? Wow. We waited 3 years for that book, and it was like, oh, great. We waited 3 years to be kicked in the head by a centaur. It's one of the most depressing. That's Harry Potter's Negretto. Everything that Harry is taken away from him in the black novel of the series. He's not the head of the witch team. He's not a prefect. His friends are. He can't figure out this whole thing with Cho Chang. Dolores Umbridge is at Hogwarts, and Harry actually says at one point, I think I'd rather be on Privet Drive. Things have gone sour at Hogwarts when Harry is talking about it. His father, who he reveres, he learns is a jerk. Everything about Harry and Order of the Phoenix is strict for him. He can't play Quidditch. He's kicked off the Quidditch team. And what's left of Harry at the end of the Black Stage is just his essence, the prophecy. How do we know the Black Stage comes to an end? That's why. Because Sirius Black's cousin blasts him through the shroud, you know? And Black dies at the end of the Black novel. Pretty straightforward. We go to the White novel.
stupid gap. And they're like, who is this guy? He makes such stupid mistakes. I'm like, not what I bring to the table. Well, sometimes I'm not a confused Voldemort and Dumbledore I haven't already, so get ready for that. This way, your game will happen. You get it? Check. Where was I before? Oh, the white. The Albedo Gnome. Dumbledore is off the stage in the Black Gnome. He's just nowhere to be found. And all of a sudden, he reappears. Everything is cool. He thinks that the Dark Lord will be looking at Harry's star. Why that is? He had a bad time before. Okay, sure, Alice. But he comes back in the White Gnome, and they're drinking like crazy. Everything is, they're just drinking alcohol, and there's snowstorms, and there's rain. There's all sorts of wetness going on. And the entire story in Half-Blood Prince is about Harry's preparation, Harry's purification for his confrontation with the Dark Lord in the last book. And we know when Harry is ready at the end of the White Stage because Mr. White himself takes a dive off the tower. And the White Stage is over because Albus Dumbledore is out. And things are looking bad for Rubius Hagrid at that point, right? We're thinking, wow, we got a red man here. We're going to the Red Stage, and so far the black and the white guys have not done so well. But I wrote Deathly Hallows Lectures, the Deathly Hallows Lectures is probably the most brilliant alchemical novel ever written. From the gold to the alchemical wedding starts off, everything's gold there. They have the French, the wet side, the floor is the cold and wet, and the Weasley is the hot and dry. They're joined there with the Red King. He's the Red King, obviously. She's the White Queen. Joined there at the end of the story. And their black time and a long camping trip that would never end. How many of you who read that thought, oh no, we waited for this forever. It's just going to be a long camping trip. Order of the Phoenix, part two. You know, like, oh my goodness, please, let us move away from the woods. There's that black stage, and then they go into the forest in snow, and there's the white doe, and they go into the Ron the Baptist scene. Ron is in the military, has a con. It's one of the great alchemical, Arthurian pieces ever written. That's the chapter she prefers to read. Whenever she reads the chapter, she reads the chapter so good. That's the white of the thing, when Ron finally kills his two eyeballs. Great stuff. And then we have the Red Stage. You can tell the Red Stage started because the white dragon has pinkish scales, moving from the white to the red. Not so good in movies. Every book the right colors. Shell Cottage, we put white stones and the red clay of Dobby's grave, whatever. We're moving from white to red here, and then it builds up, and we have a wild conflict. And we have all sorts of red people in that book. All sorts of revelation, all sorts of resolution contraries. Rufus Scrimgeour, he's the red bat. He dies before the wedding and the reception ends. Rubius Hagrid is bad for him in the Battle of Hogwarts, but he comes out of it. Apparently, Cho promised to her sister that she would not kill Rubius. Actually, she never planned to kill him. The whole thing of him carrying Harry out of the forest was a point of his. It's the circle being completed and carrying Harry out of the wreckage. But who does die at the end of the red novel? From Red Weasley. That's why Fred dies instead of George. Because he has a red in his name. Huh, Wayne Maul. Only Fred knows. Only Fred knows. Yeah, we have the wedding. And usually that chemical couple, they die. The Red King and White Queen, but they didn't die. They didn't decide not to kill Floor and Dill. Decided to kill who? What couple dies? Maybe her. Luke and Tom have died. She said that in an interview. She said they had to die because of a structural requirement. And it was an interview with Daniel Radcliffe, and like Ron, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, he nods his head and goes on to the next subject. I'm like, whoa, brother, how about asking about the structural requirement? Natalie, she also said that she understood her love of Harry Potter as a Christ, that she really thought Dumbledore more, less of a Christ figure, more of a John the Baptist figure. And Radcliffe moves on to the next question. What? Dumbledore as John the Baptist? What? Until you get to meet her, a doctor, we won't know what that means. Alright. Reasons why she has never agreed to interview with me. Alright. Now, why does this work? Why does this work? A couple of reasons. One, you want to tell a great story. You're totally engaged, and all of your barriers are down. You're not thinking, I'm being sugared into a cathartic experience where a civil device is going to rush in right when Harry's about to die, and he's going to rise again from the dead, and I'm going to have a resurrection experience just like I always wanted. You know, it doesn't happen that close to the surface, but it happens in every single book. Symbol of Christ zooms in right when Harry's about to die. And you have that, I mean, in the first one, he rises from the dead in 3 days. Not especially so. We know that difference. Who do I know that rose from the dead in 3 days? This happens in every single one of the books. And yet, how does it work? How do we get it? Because we're not getting it consciously. Well, back to that elision of subject and object. Now, how is she getting us to identify with Harry so profoundly that when Harry goes through these experiences, we experience them? How many of you, when you've read the books 5 or 6 times, still come to the end and do the, Snape is a good guy? What part of it is the voice, you know, where you get suckered into believing that you're getting a large view of things when actually you're looking through the world, the eyes of a 13 or 14-year-old boy? And there are very few things on the planet Earth that are dumber than a 13 or 14-year-old boy. I was one of those ones. I and you get to the end and you have the same feeling Harry does. Oh, how did I miss that? Because you saw everything, but by hearing this direction, you miss how important it was. But that isn't really, even though the voice is all over Harry's head, that's only one part of identifying with Harry. The other part is he's an orphan. And if you can't identify with an orphan, you know, again, see Harry. Right? The reason, Dickens writes 15 or 16 novels, and only Pickwick, there's one other, only Pickwick and one other novel does not feature a child who is either separated from his parents or has no parents. Because it works. You pick up the book and you do the, that poor kid, I hate everybody else in the story. I'm with him or little Dale, I'm on their side. You are losers. And so you've been sucked into this engagement. And Dickens, I think, dies because in Edmund Drood, he has 3 sets of torments. He like orphaned out, orphaned over, died in his novel. He went from the super orphan spectacular. Free ring orphan novel. The big thing that Rowling does that works is she does something called a soul triptych inside the books. And this is an alchemical thing, it's simply gets you into it. Remember, your heart is looking for its reflection, it's looking for its image, so that it will identify with that image and take on whatever purification that object takes. So look for the heart carrier. Who's the heart carrier? And in schoolboy novels, after Tom Brown, there's always 3 characters. There's the happy-go-lucky, lower middle class, arrival on the scene, not quite up to snuff, hero or heroine, it's a girl schoolboy novel, but Tom Brown obviously is Tom Brown. And he has a good mate who's not very good in the classroom, but is okay on the rugby field. And then we have his relatively effeminate friend who is super wonkish and great in the classroom, helps him out with the Latin Greek translation. And that's all through these books, this whole tradition in English literature. He's blighting the whole thing. you have that trio. Rowling does a couple of things to spin on that. Obviously, you recognize Harry, Ron, and Hermione in that, but not just being a co-ed thing. Hermione's not only a feminine, she's a girl. Which has its awkward moments, obviously, when the two start to lock lips. But she decides to stir in a little Dostoevsky. How many of you have read the greatest novel ever written as Brothers Karamazov? That's not a very good showing for this crowd. Okay. I have a son named Zosimov. Zosimov is one of the heroes of Brothers Karamazov. Actually, it's because my wife chose the name. I was not really on board with my kid Zosimov, but my marriage was worth saving. All my friends in high school, though, who knew that I loved the various books came also, emailed me to say, John, there is loving Dostoevsky and there is going to fall. I get it. The first thing you know is going to say. In Dostoevsky, Brothers Karamazov, there are three brothers. One is Dmitri. He's a passionate guy. He is totally out of control. He's drinking, he's whoring, he's playing cards, he's shooting people. He is a madman. Then there's Ivan. Ivan is the Russian Dr. Spock. No spaceship. Okay? Cool, rational, really hardcore. And then there's Alyosha. Alyosha is really the saint of the book. He's the youngest brother. And he's attendant to Father Zosimov in the monastery, the great saint. And he has the spiritual aspect. It's not some Puritan cardboard pious figure. He's really a man of the heart. And that body, mind, spirit, soul triptych, because it's in the greatest novel ever written, it's also a detective novel. Don't get stuck on the whole thing of Dostoevsky is Dostoevsky, and you pick it up and you're like, I'm reading Dostoevsky. It's a real page-turning mystery, detective novel. But you know, you have these three brothers, and Dostoevsky is an Orthodox Christian. He's in the Athenian elders, and they taught, as Isaac the Syrian taught, and that is that the soul has three faculties. It has the faculties of passions, usually called the belly. That's the passions. That's the faculty of the will. This is the thumia, the desires, the epithumia, the willing quality. And then it has the cardiac intelligence, the spiritual faculty, the heart, the nous in Greek. In scripture, the Jesus of Nazareth is called the heart. This is those three brothers. They're one family. They're obviously alien to each other, but together they're this family. And as you experience the book, those faculties inside of you identify with each one of them and their relationship with the other. And you get this soul triptych. Triptych is a Russian Greek word for a three-paneled icon. So you see these three figures in their one image. You may think, oh, that's just Dostoevsky. No, that's Bones, Spock, and Kirk. That's the three hobbits on Mount Doom. Because Vatican I, that's the gall is the body. How do you take care of the body if you're a Vatican I Catholic? Into the flames with you, buddy. And Will is Sam Ganji, right? I'm going to carry you up the mountain. You know? I can't be stopped. I'm just going to be ever ready now. You know, so I'm going to go. And then there's Frodo. The long-suffering hobbit, right? That image of the soul trinity is how you identify with them and how you experience. Because which one of those figures does your heart identify with? If it identifies with Gollum, again, you have my sympathy. Check the other pages under psychiatry, you know? That person you identify with is the heart person, is the sacrificial person, is the person who does the saving people, the selfless person.
the person who really makes the saving people thing because they're to make the hard, selfless, ascetic choice. The person who understands the patristic dictum that pleasure and pain are always conjoined. So choose pain because it will result in pleasure, profound pleasure. If you choose pleasure, drugs, adultery, cheating, whatever, it always results in horrific pain. Don't choose pleasure, choose pain. And that's the heart's wisdom. Harry, Ron, and Hermione are rolling soul trip, and she does it in a way that's so compelling, because they're much tighter than all these other ones. I mean, Bones does this, he's dead, Jim, Spock is that, but they don't really bond in any way. The trio are the trio from the troll moment on. Right here together, and the most agonizing parts of the book is when there's a breakup in the trio. How many of you cry, like I do, every time God of Fire, when Ron apologizes to Harry in the tent after the first trimester tournament task? Well, it's our ball right here. It's our lady, it's a great thing. Why is that such a satisfying and compelling moment? Because up to that time, we have, the first time we've seen the trio shattered, and our soul, which has always been felt really good about the stories, because these faculties are in a very strict hierarchical relationship. The desires serve the will, and the will serves the heart. The heart is in command, up and down. Harry's in charge, Hermione tells Ron where to take the lunch. Now, whenever that's wrong, when her mind thinks something about the broom, or and then decides she's bagging this, she's lucky, she's going to want to deal with her at all. When Ron decides to take a breather or whatever from Harry, hates Harry, Goblet of Fire, when Ron does the real big betrayal thing in Deathly Hallows, it's agony. Because we have so identified with these three characters and their right alignment that when they're out of alignment, we are out of alignment. And when they snap back together, we are right side up, maybe for the first time in our lives. Because we live in a desire-driven culture. Right? 20% of America. We live in a culture that's based on advertising. Believe me, they're not appealing to your transcendent human faculty when they have a woman draped over their car in the advertising. And the guy says to his wife, "It gets good gas mileage." Don't give me the rational bit, guys. You know, it's that part of you that we're appealing to. Right? Advertisers are only to get your desires, to tell your will, to smash your transcendent or spiritual understanding. And we live in a culture that does that all the time. So we read a story, and the heart character, which is Katniss Everdeen, which is Bella Swan, same soul triptych there. Who's the body in Twilight? Hint, he's the guy without the shirt. There's Jacob, you know. "Hey, Bella, how are you, dear?" There he is, the body, and he's hot. You know, he's hot and warm and warm-blooded. And then there's Edward, the mind. "I can see all things and know all things." And then there's Bella, who calls herself the heart 37 times in the room. Not especially so. I get it. You're the heart character. Katniss Everdeen, very much like that. Except she's the soul, really. The gale is the body and nature. In the beginning of the book, the soul and the body are conjoined in the natural world. At the reaping, which is death, the soul sacrifices herself for Primrose, which is a symbol for the world, the four points of light. And she goes basically to die, and PETA appeared at her side. PETA is the cross. And all through the story, PETA represents basically her salvation. If you don't believe that, think about who else would sleep with Jennifer Lawrence and not touch her. They avoid time. But again, the soul triptych thing works profoundly. And Roy pulls this off, so we identify with this. So as Harry goes through these alchemical stages and cycles, we experience them along with it. And it works. It works at a level that's hard to believe. Stephanie Meyer, people think she's a nut. Well, she was the first one to figure this out. All her books are black, white, and red. All her books are soul cryptics. That stupid Mormon housewife. That's what she's dismissed as, right? I mean, like 75 million copies of the books or whatever? This doesn't sell books or whatever. She reads, she's a voracious reader, and she went to BYU and studied with a man named Stephen Walker, one of the great Tolkien scholars of our age. You know, laugh dismissively at Stephanie Walker, Stephanie Meyer, if you want, because she writes in the Harlequin Romance field, and that's not a good thing for respect. Don't write Harlequin Romance if you want respect, especially good vampire people. But obviously she got a compelling audience. And then Susanna Collins, who has an MFA from NYU, and really invite me back and talk about the Hunger Games and the album. Every one of the Hunger Games books, when they go into the games, it's a black and white and red stage inside of me. Remember the fire in the first part, they go into the first games, and then this big rainstorm inside the cave, and they come together in the cornucopia, as a chemical symbol for the rebellion of the end stage, or whatever. Collins works it hard, each one of those things. And the pearl, the symbolism of the pearl throughout the books, is because the pearl is not chemical symbol of solid light, just like gold. That's why a pearl is so continues so valuable, it's hard and light. And the major characters help other people. Mags saves them in the second games' trials, because, and what does Mags' name mean? And the Margaret that comes with the thing to save Gale when he's whipped in the public square, they bring the basically the anesthetic to help him get over this stuff. Her name is also Margaret. What does Margaret mean in Greek? Pearl. Okay. Not especially subtle, but there it is. Collins works this stuff hard because she gets that it works in her father. I mean, stunning how two women have figured out that, gosh, Rowling has sold quite a few books. Maybe we could take a page from her playbook. Maybe we could look inside her toolbox and see if there's anything I can pick up. A little different genre, same thing, works out. But how does this help us? I mean, yes, it helps understand the artistry and the meaning of Harry Potter. When the books start to say, Harry Potter, here's this woman on the dole, she got lucky, she read a funny story, everybody loved it, it was all marketing. You can say, well, not really. But what does it really mean for us beyond our understanding these stories and why we love them? It's about the stories you write about yourselves. Every one of you is a novelist, whether you like it or not. You've been writing a novel of your life really since you were an adolescent. And some of us have fallen off the wagon and had to go for counseling and have the counselor rewrite our stories and say, no, this is the way the story is actually going. Oh, okay. That is a better story than the one I've been writing. I don't know any story where I'm just a stupid, you know, crazy guy. Now that storytelling aspect of ourselves is really the most important part. What story do we tell ourselves, about the world we live in? Is it about our transformation? Is it about our heroic aspiration? Is it about our transcendence of the world, our saving people thing? Or is it just me getting more pleasure and avoiding more pain? When you read Harry Potter and you come through it and get to the end and say, you know, I think I can read that again for the 27th time. All right? And she doesn't want to do it. The reason we do that again and again and again is because you like the experience of being right side up. We like the experience of doing of reading a story in which we're engaged, in which we are. I'm always amazed at how brave I am on the side of Harry Potter. Oh yeah, we're going to the Ministry of Magic. Get the festivals. Come on, let's take off. This is the guy that's afraid of, you know, frogs and snakes. You know, I'm going to go back to the festival of Harvard. Take me out the Elvis and Middle Lane. I'm ready to go. I've so identified successfully. Read it to tell you a story. I have two daughters who are nuns, believe it or not. And one of them, who's now Sister Bellia, was a 5-foot-tall ball of will. And
She liked to play the violin. She liked to play the violin for money. It was like a bus on the street of Port Townsend, Washington, and she was a cute little blonde-haired girl playing the violin with an open violin cage. She was making more money than I was. She'd go downtown for like 45 minutes and go home with like, you know, $200 on weekends. I'm doing that. What am I doing wrong? I'm not 5 feet tall, blonde, and you know, 10 years old, right? That's like, they don't do that for Dobby. You know, Dobby with a violin is not going to do that. Like, take Sophia and our big family van, our 7 kids, and the big family van, and I had a really unpleasant errand for them. Now, I'll end with this story, really. I had to give papers to a friend that I had a financial agreement with, that had proved to him that he had basically cheated me of a lot of money. I don't do confrontation very well. I had 6 years in the Marine Corps. That's a whole different type of confrontation. Okay. I do kill at 500 meters with a rifle very well. I don't do, you're a bad guy, and I'm going to give me my money. I don't do that very well. I want to escalate that usually because I want to shoot you at 500 meters. I only have one good friend and I love you, or gosh, 500 meters is a very long ways. You really want to take this up. There's little guys at the age. But I'm in between. So I'm really uncomfortable. I have to give them the papers and show them this. It's going to be a confrontation. It's going to be a confrontation. It's going to be a room. And I have to take Sophia to a Bible lesson. So I drop the papers off, take Sophia. So I drive into the parking lot. The guy has his office. And I get out. Sophia gets out. She's got her rollerblades on. Little girl in a skirt, big ponytail, you know, pretty cute, right? I'm thinking, that would be a lot more fun if I could do rollerblading with my daughter rather than going in with my papers. And I'm thinking, okay, she's gonna rollerblade for a while while I'm in here. And I get to the door. I go in, and again, she's what's wrong, Dad? I gotta prevent my friend with these, like my former friend with these things. I'm just sad. I'm really sad about this whole thing. How's it played out? So at the end of the day, she's about money. It's stupid. She's like, yeah. I'm not gonna have any of what we're talking about. It's like, I'm sad. So she gets out of the car, out of the van, and she's biking around. And I hit the door, and my hand goes to the door. Right next to me comes my daughter. And I said, what are you doing? She says, well, I'm going inside with that. What do you mean? She goes, it's just like your father. Friends know that friends, he's different. Seven to there's ring composition, there's her postmodern artistry, there's her genre work, there's her delayed, her narrative delayed action. I mean, there's seven things inside Harry Potter that have been used and not used by other authors to make these attempts. And she steals from the King Rowling, is a master. We have a new ticket among us. If you read her new books, I'm going to try, she's doing the same thing. It's a magnificent book. We're going to see the same explosion when the third book comes out next month, Career of Evil. We're going to see the same kind of explosion we saw in Prisoner of Azkaban. If you haven't read the first two books, you've got 3 weeks. You should read them twice before them. You won't get any of the nuance until you've read them at least 4 or 5 times. But you did hear it. Very exciting times for us. These are the most exciting times for Harry Potter fans to be alive. There's a whole renaissance in Harry Potter scholarship. There's 3 books coming out. One came out last week, Ravenclaw Reader. It's the anthology of talks given at the University of St. Andrews Harry Potter Commons. Right? And with responses from Potter pundits from around the world to those talks. And a critical biography at the end. And next month, we get Harry Potter for Nerds Part 2, which has the best things that have been written in fandom and academic scholarship of Harry Potter in the last year. And another one is Into the Pensieve by Patrick McCauley at Chestnut Hill College, which really the world-changing event there is where he talks about violence against women and how it's the underlying theme of almost everything that goes on inside Harry Potter. Totally rocking my world. Into the Pensieve, which you can get. And all the Harry Potter conferences are going back to the books. We've had 10 years basically when the films have superseded the experience inside the stories, inside the novels. You do not have this cardiac experience inside a movie. Because it's a sense experience. It's not an imaginative experience. You don't suspend this belief inside a film. You may experience story, you may press down your disbelief or whatever, but you don't have a cardiac experience. There are very few transformational experiences inside film. It's almost always fear and sentiment. It's the only thing you can do inside a film. So for 10 years, we've been dealing with the movies as trailers for the books. People see the films and then they read the books, but the films have largely colored their experience of the books. Now, we're enough removed from the movies that we're beginning to see a return of the books. There's a Harry Potter conference called Leviosa, it's going to be in Las Vegas in July. It's all about the books. It's going to be a LeakyCon conference, totally devoted to the Harry Potter books instead of all the other young adult fiction. The group that shall not be named, the biggest Harry Potter fan group in the world in New York City, is having their MysticCon in New Hampshire again next year, only about the books. Do you see a trend? Really, if you're in Harry Potter, what it means for literature and story, this is the most exciting time. Almost all of you have my card. If you don't have my card, you didn't get to it in time. I have 5 more cards on my card. I want you to write to me. You've got questions, you've got answers, you've got thoughts. If you want to participate right now, the unlocking press is if you bought Ravenclaw Reader, you can actually see the videos that St. Andrews made at the talks at the conference. And get this, there'll be live webinars with the people who spoke at the conference. So you can read the book, then hear and watch the talk, and then talk to the speaker about what you think of the side of the thing. I mean, really, because of the internet, these are the most exciting times to be a Harry Potter student. I was a keynote speaker at that conference at St. Andrews. It was a wow. Not my talk was a wow, but that was what I was like. And to have been there was a magnificent thing. But for those of us who didn't, they flew me over and my wife. That was very nice of them. I could never have gone if they hadn't paid my way to do that. Now we can have an experience very much like it inside this thing. If you want that experience, go to Unlocking Press, sign up for the mailing list, and I'll send you links to those videos and stuff like that. You should buy the book, though. My email address, right, Angela, thank you. My email address is john@hogwartsprofessor.com. How hard is that to you? Write to me, tell me what you think, tell me where I've gone wrong, and then tell our friends here to invite me back, and I'll tell you about all the things that happened under these in the ministry.
couldn't play a ball to him.
Don't you wish that I had read that thing? It was so much better in the written copy.
I doubt it. Very nice. Thank you. John, I think, is going to stick around if he has a little bit of voice left. He brought some of the books if you'd like to purchase them here. You could probably sign them. No?
I can sign the keynote talk that I did, but the rest I can't. They're, that's great.
No, I volunteered you for signing.
If you want to buy them here, they're 20 bucks for one and 30 bucks for two. There's that. And I have no change.